Hello, and welcome to Fidelity Connects by Fidelity Investments Canada, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. In this episode, Peter Bowen, Vice President of Tax and Retirement Research, outlines the possible tax implications of newly elected President Joe Biden. Peter explains how these possible changes will affect Canadians living and working in the U.S. and what it means for estate planning and foreign U.S. assets. Peter also touches upon passive foreign investment companies. These PFIC changes will influence Canadian investors who are U.S. citizens, but corporate class funds on the Canadian side are a huge benefit for Canadian investors. But PFIC rules can create challenges as well. Peter says in general, it's currently unclear as to the extent of these changes to tax policies because control of the Senate is still up in the air in the U.S., and whatever the outcome will have large implications on many tax issues such as tax credit and retirement contributions. Commentary surrounding COVID-19 and financial markets is frequently changing. Today's podcast was recorded on November 12, 2020. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada, ULC, or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Peter, welcome to the show.
Great. Thank you very much, Kelly, and welcome everyone. It's certainly an exciting time from a U.S. tax perspective. Lots going on south of the border, some craziness, shall we say, but nonetheless. We do have a new president-elect in the United States, and we have a sense of the changes that Biden will be trying to put through. So we're going to walk through, and now we have to bear in mind that it's unclear how much of this that President-elect Biden and his partner Harris will be able to get through, because they may not have control of the Senate, remains to be seen. But certainly this is the direction that they will be looking to handle. So platform, and this first slide talking about the personal tax changes that are proposals at this stage. And a lot of this goes to, some of this certainly goes to reversing some of the tax reform that was brought in by President Trump, passed into law about just under 3 years ago. So firstly, when we look at the income tax rates for the top marginal rate, it had been reduced from 39.6% to 36%. And Biden wants to take that back up to 39.6 on income above $400,000. Now, it's U.S. dollars, of course. Points out one of the big challenges that Canada has, in that our top tax rates are, for the most part, significantly higher than those in the United States, and they kick in at much lower levels than the United States. So we're already in that position, and we've got a federal government that's dealing with, in Canada, that's dealing with very large deficits and debt, and wants to tax wealth, extreme wealth inequality. We don't know what that means yet, so we got to keep our eyes on that. But we already have a challenge in terms of differential in tax rates, even if Biden is successful in pushing this through. And I'd also, we can come back to a couple other aspects on that. But the other thing he wants to do is to bring in additional payroll taxes. So payroll taxes stop applying above a certain relatively modest amount of income. There will continue to be a gap where there's no payroll taxes, and then income above 400,000 will be subject to those payroll taxes. That's for Social Security, similar in a sense to CPP, not exactly though. Finally, itemized deductions, which people can currently get obviously, as the word suggests, a deduction at their marginal tax rate. Well, Biden wants to bring that down so it's at 28%, so more akin to a tax credit. So again, we'll have to wait and see how much of this he can get through, but that's where they are aiming to go. I should also note that the 39.6, that's the federal rate. A number of states do, of course, have their own income taxes, and but not all do. So when we look at top marginal rates in the United States, you really have to focus in on which state. The variability there is much greater than what we have in Canada. Next, income above $1 million. Biden wants to say that investment income will be taxed at full rates. So the United States, just like Canada, treats certain types of investment income on a preferential basis. He's proposing to make that go away. Retirement contributions. So someone puts money into a 401k, roughly equivalent to an RSP. Right now they get a deduction, of course. And then when they take the money out, it's taxable. Biden thinks that's unduly generous to people in high tax rates and is proposing to convert that to tax credits. That's an interesting one to me when I think about what we have in Canada, if we were to do the same. So you've got an RSP deduction, so to someone in the top tax rate, they get a deduction at 50% or so, or perhaps a bit higher, depending on the province they're in, and then they pull it out in retirement. Well, what if that was converted to a tax credit at, say, 25%? A lot of high income earners, I would suggest, might stop contributing to RSPs in that scenario. So just like when I'm talking about Canadian tax policy, we have to talk about behavioral issues. Same in the United States, it might change behaviors. And finally, Biden is proposing to increase the child and dependent tax credit quite significantly. So that's the personal tax side. So when U.S. Individuals pass away, if there's no surviving spouse, they are, and even then they can be subject to the estate tax. But by and large, let's think about someone without a surviving spouse. They are taxed at a fairly high tax rate, 40%, on assets above an exemption threshold, which right now is quite high at $11.6 million, roughly. That is already scheduled to drop back down to $5.8 million, in half, essentially, in 2026. That's part of the rules as they are currently enacted. Biden is proposing to take that down further and quicker, to $3.5 million. So when we think about how this impacts Canadians in particular, who aren't US citizens, so Canadians who pass away and have US situs assets, so that can be a house in Florida or Phoenix, it's shares of directly held equities, for instance. If the individual's worldwide estate, and that's everything, that's their RSP, the place in Canada, the chalet in Whistler or the cottage in Muskoka, whatever they might have, the place in Phoenix or Florida, RSPs, TFSAs, shares of private corporations, right? If all that exceeds the threshold, they can pay U.S. taxes on the U.S. situs assets. Well, at $11.6 million, very few people are caught. At $5.8 million, quite a few more people will be caught. At $3.5 million, a lot of Canadians will be impacted by this. So you want to think long-term for your Canadians in terms of how their affairs are structured. Is that house in Phoenix held in a trust? I'm not suggesting that. There's a lot of complexity, a lot of costs that go along with those types of strategies. What about those shares of direct equities, right? Even if they're in an RSP, even if they're in a Canadian brokerage account, still caught. Well, if you use a Canadian offered mutual fund to get that US equity exposure, not caught, not considered a US situs asset. So it's a way to deal with this in the long run. The other change on the estate tax front is that Biden wants to increase the rate from 40 to 45%. Now, tied in with this, and it's not truly an estate tax, but it's at the same time, is he wants to get rid of what's referred to as the basis step up. So let me explain this one because it's really interesting and it's arguably a big loophole. So when, Canadians often say, oh, well, we don't have an estate tax. The U.S. does. We should have an estate tax. Okay, fair enough. We don't have an estate tax per se, but we do tax, assuming, again, no surviving spouse, the value of our RSPs and RIFs at death, but also unrealized gains get triggered, right? They don't in the United States. So someone has purchased a mutual fund for $200,000. It's gone up to $700,000 by the time they've passed away because it's, you know, been a long-term hold. Well, it transfers to the next generation. That gain doesn't get triggered for tax purposes, and the next generation takes on the gain, takes on cost basis at the new higher level. So if they sell that investment immediately, that gain is never taxed. That's very different than the Canadian situation. It's a big loophole. It doesn't just affect the wealthy, but the wealthy obviously particularly benefit from it. And there's a lot of tax planning that goes with this. So when we, you know, when we talk about bringing in a Canadian estate tax, well, we have to bear in mind that we're already different than the U.S. Biden is proposing to get rid of this basis step up. Again, going to affect more than just the wealthy. It's going to affect your U.S. citizens here in Canada when, you know, they pass away. It will change estate planning. I've read at least one article, a couple articles that suggests that this loophole is particularly beneficial to people who own a lot of real estate, for instance, hotels. So that's a big potential change. Third area, which is corporate taxes. The Trump reform took the corporate tax rate down from 35%, which was, you know, globally very high, to 21%. Biden wants to bring that up to 28%. This one probably has a higher than a lot of the other ones expectation of getting through because a lot of Republicans even thought that the 21% was a step too far and had argued for 28%. So we might see that coming through. Biden also wants to bring in an alternative minimum tax applicable to book income in excess of, I believe it's $100 million. And he wants to make some changes to the taxation of foreign income. Right now it's referred to as GILTI, the Global Intangible Low Taxed Income. Great acronym, right? This affects some of your clients here in Canada. Think about the doctor who is carrying on business through a private corporation, a professional corporation. If that doctor is a U.S. citizen, he or she might be getting taxed on this GILTI right now. And because it's foreign income from a U.S. perspective, of course. Right? And Biden wants to take the tax rate on this to 21%, which is essentially doubling it. But he's also doing some other tweaks. So if this goes through, this will have a significant effect on a lot of your clients. I'm going to pause there. And Kelly, do we have any questions that have come in that we want to hit at this point in time? Just because there's a lot we've hit there, and we will have time at the end as well if people want to, if there's something they think about as we go through the next section, of course. But do we have any questions we want to address right now?
Absolutely. Lots of things coming in around real estate, but I've got one, and I'd like to leave that to the end. There's one here that says, when dealing with those U.S. estate taxes on situs assets, how and when do they handle the currency conversion?
So the currency conversion, that would flow through the U.S. estate tax return. But everything gets reported in U.S. dollars, of course, on that U.S. tax return. So if someone passed away as of today, it would be today's exchange rate that one would use, is my understanding, is on the U.S. estate tax return in terms of determining, firstly, worldwide assets, and secondly, the value of the U.S. situs asset. And I should note that many of your clients may end up having to file U.S. estate tax returns, even if they're not subject to the tax. I had to go through this with my mother-in-law who passed away a few years ago, you know, nowhere near the limit, less than a tenth of the limit, which was at that time the $5 million limit. And yet we had to file a U.S. estate tax because she had an IRA. And so we had to go through this and say what the value of all those assets was. And we used the FX rate at time of death to convert the Canadian holdings to U.S. dollars.
Okay. Okay, excellent. Okay, I've got a bunch of questions here. I want to keep those to the end because I want to make sure we cover off. I think you're going to give us an update on some of the PFIC rules.
Okay, because there have been a few developments on PFIC that I'd like to just bring to people's attention, potentially opportunities. So PFICs, there are passive foreign investment companies, is what a PFIC is. And these rules affect your Canadian clients who are U.S. citizens. And, you know, it can be broader than that. It's U.S. persons, which includes U.S. residents. So if someone moves to the United States and continues to hold Canadian mutual funds, for instance, they're going to get caught by these rules as well. But let's by and large, we're dealing with U.S. citizens living in Canada. And remember, they have to file a U.S. tax return in addition to a Canadian tax return. Usually or often they don't pay much in the way of U.S. tax, if anything, because they can take the Canadian tax liability, which they determine first, and offset it on their U.S. return as a foreign tax credit. But the PFIC rules can create some challenges there. So the taxation on PFICs is punitive unless you can get certain information, which comes through what's called the annual information statement. And if we get that information, we can make what's called the qualified electing fund, or QEF, election. Then the taxation is much more sensible. So the first update that I want to bring to people's attention is I've added this little asterisk and said, pre-2004 exception for trust versions? Question mark. So Canadian mutual funds have generally been considered to be PFICs, and that's whether they're corporations or trusts. Now you might look at the PFIC, you know, rule on the face of it, it says companies, that's corporations. But trusts are generally considered, Canadian trusts, Canadian mutual fund trusts, are considered corporations under these rules. There is an argument, though, that mutual funds formed prior to 2004 as trusts, so not mutual fund corporations, which are, you know, corporate class funds, but trusts, arguably aren't PFICs. So it's a filing position that your client might want to consider. There is a lawyer, U.S. tax lawyer named Max Reed, who was in New York and he's moved to the Vancouver area, and he's put out some fairly thoughtful pieces on these issues, and you can Google search and find it, Max Reed, and he suggests that there's a good filing position to say they're not PFICs. And if I was a U.S. citizen, I might want to look at that. And, you know, Fidelity, as an example, we have a number of mutual funds that are trusts that were formed prior to 2004, so could give the opportunity for that filing position. I should say, you know, that's up to the individual working with their own tax advisor. You know, individual might want to say, hey, heard about this position, and here's the link. Make their own decision about whether they want to take that as a filing position. But that makes all the PFIC issues go away. Not that they're at the end of the day, though, as long as we can make that election. PFIC, firstly, what are caught? So Canadian mutual funds, corporations or trusts, again, with that arguable exception. Exchange-traded funds, corporate class funds, just to be careful there because we get certain tax benefits from a Canadian tax perspective because we've got a number of class funds in one mutual fund corporation. It's one taxable entity. Well, when we think about it from a U.S. perspective, though, we have to, what we're really doing is going back and recalculating everything using U.S. tax rules. And Fidelity does this. We do this with all of our mutual funds. The problem from a U.S. perspective is that we don't get the same benefits, right? The Canadian benefits line up because we have multiple class funds in the same one taxable entity. From a U.S. perspective, we have to look at each class fund on its own. We lose those benefits, which come to a large degree because we offset expenses of some against income of others, losses of some against gains of others, those sort of things. We don't get that from a U.S. perspective. So class funds don't give the same benefits for the U.S. citizen investors and creates timing issues, and that can create a U.S. tax liability in some circumstances. Now, I said we'd give that information for all of our Canadian offered funds. If I step back to ETFs, that's why I had it on the list, was We will also be doing that for our exchange-traded funds. So Fidelity offers a suite of exchange-traded funds. But here's the challenge. When it comes to that information, we provide the annual information statement, and it's a fairly straightforward document that you can get from our transfer agency system, and it provides the information that your clients need for a U.S. tax perspective. How much ordinary earnings do they have, and how much capital gains do they have from the mutual fund, determined using U.S. tax rules. Now, to do that, we run two engines. The first one is to run an engine on the fund itself using those U.S. tax rules. That tells us how much income per day per unit. We then run that against the transfer agency so we can tell the client that, hey, their ordinary earnings were $312 and their capital gains were $673. Great, pretty straightforward. Put it on a form on the U.S. tax return, done. With ETFs, the challenge is we don't have the second engine, nor do our competitors. So when we look at an ETF, we're simply going to say, hey, it's 0.0371 cents per unit per day of ordinary earnings and some other number, fraction of a cent for capital gains. You do the math. So if a client held a fund for 6 months out of the year or added to their position or, all these things going on, that becomes a real challenge. So it's just a caution to watch out for ETFs. Fund of funds, we want to be careful with those because unfortunately we have to do a filing for each of the underlying funds as well as the top fund. Doesn't make any sense, but that's the way the rules are structured. RSPs and RIFs were good. TFSAs, they're a bit more problematic. A lot of U.S. tax providers will say, hey, U.S. citizen, don't have a TFSA. Two reasons. One is there's an additional tax filing potential form that's complicated and very expensive to do. And secondly, the IRS won't recognize a TFSA as tax-free. The income's taxable. Again, I'm going to go back to that fellow named Max Reed because he's put out some, thoughtful pieces on this, say that the TFSA, those additional filings, the expensive, painful ones, aren't necessary because a TFSA doesn't qualify under the category that requires those. So if your client's willing to take that position, that's good news. The income's still taxable. The PFIC rules still apply. But in many cases, clients have what are called excess foreign tax credits that can offset the income in the tax-free savings account on the U.S. tax return. It goes back to being tax-free. It can make sense. So it's just a potential opportunity once TFSA values are high enough that they could make sense for U.S. citizens. Right? And I think we're getting to that point, given the accumulated room that people have. Finally, RESPs, they pretty much will require those other the other filing, the expensive filing, and they're taxable on the U.S. tax return. And the grants are taxable, so they're a bit of a challenge. So that's the whirlwind update on the PFIC rules and some opportunities for your clients to consider. Again, they've got to work with their own tax providers to make sure they're comfortable with any filing positions they take. Kelly, what do we have?
Okay, excellent, Peter. Thank you for that. I did want to say the poll results are in because we asked everyone, and apparently 74% of you said most clients who usually go to the U.S. are actually staying home this year. And I'm wondering whether there's anything our advisors should be aware of with regards to residency rules.
So that's actually a higher percentage than we got when we ran the poll on Monday, where it came in at 66%. Not a huge difference. Obviously, with the border being closed, we are expecting fewer people to be going south. But, we either had 34 or 26% where, yes, there are some people going south. I'm familiar with someone who recently flew down to Florida for the winter. What was their creative way? Well, they actually rented a private jet. I mean, it's really expensive, but they had a bunch of people on it, so the per person cost apparently wasn't ridiculous. But lots of other people are willing to fly. I mean, airlines are flying to the States, so they can go down to the United States we're seeing it. And they do have to worry about the residency rules, of course, just like in previous years. So it's a smaller subset of clients, but we've got the substantial presence test. It's a rolling 3-year calculation. Want to just make sure we stay onside that, or if we go offside it, make sure we file what's called the closer connection exemption. So it's still happening, but obviously to a lesser degree.
There's a question here, and I know we talked about what we're anticipating with the Biden-Harris presidency, but do you expect similar changes, let's say, in the Canadian tax system to be revised? Let's use COVID as a reason to perhaps do some revamping to kind of be in tune with what we're seeing south of the border.
Yeah, I don't want to spend too much time on this, given it's somewhat out of our topic today, but we've got to balance the fact that the government's made a number of statements that it doesn't think this is the time to increase taxes against the fact that in the throne speech, they said they want to figure out ways to tax extreme wealth inequality, again, whatever that is. So I think we need to keep our eye on it. Our top marginal tax rate across the country is already pretty high. It's a competitive landscape compared to what's going on in the United States, even if Biden increases those rates. Capital gains inclusion rate, that's one maybe they'll tinker with, right? 50% now, does it go to 2/3 or 3/4? Maybe. Estate taxes, I've already talked about that as a potential. It's possible. Wealth taxes is another, but again, they've done that in Europe and it has behavioral impacts and really doesn't generate a lot of tax. I should also say the estate tax doesn't generate a lot of tax in the United States. It generates a lot of planning and I'm sure a lot of revenue for tax accountants, tax lawyers.
Okay, we've got another question here. Will Canadians normally work in the U.S., but coming back to Canada due to WFH policy, how to determine their tax residency?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer offhand. If we simply look at physical presence, they would not be considered resident in the U.S., and that's probably the right way to do it. But that doesn't mean that U.S. income wouldn't be subject to U.S. taxes, though. So you would still have, I believe that income would still be subject to U.S. tax. It just changes the filing if they can be considered to be not resident in the United States. How they file, it's not their worldwide income, and now it's just their U.S. source income that's taxed, is I believe how that would play out.
Okay, excellent. What about U.S. citizens with Canadian spouses, and how are joint accounts for them impacted by U.S. tax rules?
Yeah, we get this question once in a while about joint accounts. It's complicated. It really, at the end of the day, the individual's own tax advisors will have to weigh in on this. In Canada, joint accounts, we really should be looking at who supplies the capital. So if it's all coming from a high-income person, arguably the income's all taxed on that person. The reality is people will often split that 50-50, but they're subject to audit, right? And the attribution rules might say that income's taxed in the higher-income person's hands. And what happens on the U.S. return will partly depend on how it's being filed, because are they filing individually or are they filing jointly? Because it's possible U.S., unlike Canada, couples can file jointly, which can, as a family unit, result in significant tax savings. There was a little push towards starting down that path a few years ago. Unfortunately, when the Liberals came to power, it's one of the first things they did was they got rid of the little bit towards that we'd moved. So a family making, $200,000, well, if it's all earned in the hands of one individual, the taxes are a lot higher than if it's split 50-50 between two individuals. And these tax changes, it depends on how that filing is being done in the United States.
Okay, we do have a lot of questions, so I am going to take us a little bit over the 12 o'clock mark. And I'd like to think that we're all above board here, but I do have a question. How does the IRS know a Canadian in Canada has U.S. stocks and meets the threshold when they pass? Are you supposed to declare?
The answer is yes, you are supposed to declare. How do they know? Well, they arguably don't, but the executor has liability. And we're seeing more and more people use professional executors because being an executor for a complex situation is a pain in the neck. My mother-in-law's situation wasn't very complicated, and it was a pain in the neck. So I can see why people are moving towards using professional executors, and they will not mess around with this. So they will file the U.S. estate tax return. The other thing is if it's simply U.S. stocks, that's one thing. If there's property in the U.S., that's another. If there's an IRA, like my mother-in-law had, because she and her predeceased husband had worked in the United States for a number of years, again, that's another thing that you have to file that tax return to get access to those assets. So there are lots of reasons why people end up having to file U.S. tax returns, not the least of which is that liability for the executor. Yeah, maybe it's someone's child that's the executor. Do you really want them taking on U.S. liabilities? Remember, we have to file that form T1135 to report foreign property by country. So does that information get to the IRS? Not that I'm aware of, but why are they focused on a lot of this US equity, US equities held in a Canadian brokerage account? Why is that caught? Why are we reporting that? Doesn't make any sense, but we're getting caught on that. That raises one other question I'm getting a lot these days is, people will say, "Hey, I've got this mutual fund. Can you give me the cost amount by country for the holdings of the mutual fund so I can put it on my T1135?" And the answer is no, we can't. We won't, because the mutual fund itself is not considered foreign property for the purposes of that form. So it's amazing how many accountants don't realize that even these days, even though it's been around for a few years.
I've got one here. We're going back to PFIC. Are seg funds considered PFIC also?
Seg funds are not considered PFIC, is my understanding, because they're an insurance product. There are ways to avoid the PFIC issues, but you have to balance the costs, right? So a seg fund is typically going to have a significantly higher MER. So yeah, you avoid the PFIC headaches, but you bring in additional costs. Do I buy U.S. listed ETFs? Well, they're not going to be PFICs, right? Because they're not foreign from a U.S. perspective. But if they make distributions that are tax preferred on the U.S. side, they lose that treatment. So even if it's a capital gain distribution, fully taxable on the Canadian return, you create Canadian problems. What about holding direct securities? Then the accountant's got a headache about all the different securities to track for two different purposes, two different currencies, two different sets of rules. I've had some accountants say, "Yeah, we've got some clients that have moved to that, and it's a real pain in the neck. It's worse than the PFIC rules." So same answer with the seg fund. Do you want those extra costs? But it works. It's not a PFIC.
Do you think that Canadians who've worked in the US and have 401ks will still be able to bring them to Canada?
Yes, I do. And actually, that's one of the questions my colleague Michelle Monroe and I often get is, how do we do this? It's possible. It's not great if the person's a U.S. citizen, but if they're not, it can typically be brought to Canada. Often it's better to convert it to an IRA first, but bring it to Canada, put it into an RSP, and you get an offsetting deduction. Again, got to be done very carefully. There are withholding taxes and tax credits to consider, but yes, it can be done, and I would not expect that to change.
Okay. I know we talked about real estate. There's a lot of questions that are coming in real estate around real estate. This is going to be the last one I'm going to ask you. Can you talk about the US tax implications for Canadians selling US real estate? I know you touched on it a little bit. Remind us of the current rules and if it's likely that there could be changes to these rules.
So there's something called FIRP, the Foreign Investment in Real Property Tax Act, I think, that will
Quite
nail
the
Canadians owning U.S. properties, and they will have to pay taxes in the United States on their gains. Now, typically, it's not someone's principal residence, so they will also pay tax on their Canadian tax return. Foreign tax credits come into play as well. So yeah, you pay that U.S. tax, but you may get some or all of it back when you file your Canadian tax. Also, there are headaches in terms of when you go to sell. So you can't just say, "Hey, they won't know, and I'm not going to go back to the U.S. just because I'm, 83 and I'm selling this property, and that's the end of things." Because when they go to sell the property, I think that that there is a withholding tax requirement to the purchaser when they know it's a non-resident selling the property. And I'm not expecting those rules to change to the best of my knowledge. I mean, if they tweak tax rates or, the capital gains rates, that might affect those. But I do think that those will be continuing on, and people need to think about it when they have that place in Florida or Phoenix that ultimately, there's a tax liability. And sometimes you can have a tax liability on or tax gain on one return and a loss on the other because of currency differentials. I mean, it's complex.
Well, listen, Peter, I want to stop you there. This has been a lot of information to take in. Thank you very much. And I have no doubt that we will be bringing you back, because based on the amount of questions that we didn't get a chance to get to, I think we're going to have to do that. So thank you again for your time.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. Please visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts. Don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter and subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice.